Welcome to the Maine Reader on Maine Airs, the Maine Audio Information and Reading Service, a program of the IRIS Network, serving Maine's blind and visually impaired. My name is Cynthia Bowman, and I'm reading the log of The Skipper's Wife, the diary of Dorothea Moulton Bellano, edited by her son, James W. Bellano. Our last episode showed us more life at sea, several serious storms, as well as smooth sailing. It also showed us that some elements of life there aren't very different from life on land. For example, whether on land or at sea, newlyweds probably differ often about the right time to have a baby. Dorothea wants a child very much, while her husband, Captain Fred, would prefer to wait. As we've seen many times, both members of this marriage are strong-willed. Of course, we know Dorothea wins this debate at some point, because her son is the editor of this diary. As we finished reading last time, the ship was at anchor in Jacksonville. Let's read more. March 8, 1912. Over a week since my last entry. Now that I've temporarily gained the upper hand over Fred's lust by outlusting him, just once, Jacksonville has become much less of a nightmare, and I have been so busy that I have given in to my detestation for writing, instead of living. But, for my son and daughter and some imaginary posterity, the diary must be kept alive, so we'll note down briefly what has happened. Spent nearly a day with Mrs. Hussey, she of the Friendship, Maine, Husseys, whose seagoing husband has become the chief of all shipping men in Jayville, the stevedore contractor, the tug owner, the manager of the pilots, and everything but the boss of the Sharks. Had a heavenly time listening to her darky stories with a down east accent. Laughed more at her, poor dear, than at her anecdotes. Got my new dress, and it is stunningly pretty, and fits right in all the right places. Baked a cake for lunch, when we go to Mandarin. Brightened up my cabin with more primroses, to keep company with a lovely little one given us by Miss Foote. Called on Mrs. Likes, and saw her lovely furniture. Her family are shipowners, large fleets, but nothing to compare with the Pendleton fleet of Islesboro. One of the biggest fleet of sailing ships in the world. Am I getting to be proud of Maine? Miss Foote and her beau of the brown eyes came to supper one evening. I must have developed an empathy for brown eyes when teaching my 8th grade at Utuado. Fred's are hazel. I love them, but they don't seem so outgoing and honest as brown. Mine own, being hopelessly blue, are without the pale for me. Drove with the Likes under a beautiful blue sky, the color of my eyes, Fred said, to a fairyland of moss-covered oaks, gray and green, with here and there glorious red leaves shining out in their autumn glory, all in March. Seemed out of season, like Mother Bee's Rio strawberries. Underfoot we trod on soft, mossy, swampy soil among the green lily fronds, so delicately colored. Florida is beautiful, but so is Rio, which has more than just rustic beauty. How privileged I am to dwell in the best spots on earth, the beautiful coast of Maine, exquisite Rio, exotic Florida. Then there's always France and charming England, not to speak of dirty but delightful Italy, all coming up on the horizon. Unbeknownst to Fred, I've been working on Mr. Likes for a charter to carry some of his turpentine and pine masts to England, with a call on France to pick up wine for the return cargo. Scheming me also thought, untold to others, of the rum factory of Don Jorge's family that pays premium for barrels in which wine has been shipped. They age the rum in wine hogsheads to give it an exquisite flavor. Or is it to hide the rank taste of rum? Anyhow, shall continue scheming, and hope it won't send Freddy Boy up the spanker masked when he finds out. March 16, 1912. So long since I've forced myself to keep notes for posterity. 30 times I've said, the hell with posterity, but I shall now endeavor to conscientiously relate the consecutive events. Drove to Mandarin last Sunday. After shooing our many guests over the side on Saturday evening, finished preparing for the picnic. Early Sunday we beclothed ourselves in warm raiment of gentle blue and betook ourselves to the tram, got off at the appointed spot, and after a few moments waiting, who should appear but Mr. and Mrs. Irons with their team of spanking sorrels, which pranced with us out on the long but enchanting drive to Mandarin. How we Americans do name our towns! Cairo, Illinois, pronounced Cairo, like the syrup. Maine has Mexico, Peru, Norway, China, and God knows what else. Now Florida comes along with Mandarin. It's a small, sleepy town of deserted orange farms, some 12 miles up the St. John's River from Jayville. It was settled exclusively by exclusive British, a few of whom still remain. Captain Miller has a small place there, which his wife manages while he goes to sea to pay the deficit produced by the oranges. She's a brave woman, among the water moccasins and copperheads and alligators, and very lovely. To get there we crossed several rivers, some with bridges, many with fords shallow enough and wide enough for the horses. They stopped to drink at each one. I marveled at the forests of live oaks and waded in the streams while Mr. Irons rested the team. Fred was captivated into thoughts of buying an orange farm, but, knowing him, I believe it is because he adores eating oranges. We looked at various homes after Mrs. Miller's aromatic coffee, with Fred buying each until I would slyly bring up the question of deficits and declare that I was not one to be neighborly with water moccasins while he went off to sea a whoring. Returned home without a farm and had tea at the Irons in a beautiful sunset over my sea, which sports dolphins instead of moccasins. Wearily to bed with Fred lecturing me on being decent. Nearly cried my eyes out early in the morning because he swore at me as he would at the commonest sailor. I can't stand such treatment. Guess I'll have to try to be decent, but come to think of it, I really don't know how to. Tuesday went to a matinee with Miss Foote, saw a play called Snobs. A very good company of troopers with High MacIntyre as leading man. My uncle was so fat that when he fell down he rocked himself to sleep before he could get up. Good breezy play. Wednesday towed down the river and went to sea, but the good breeze died out before we could make seaway and get off soundings, so we anchored to wait for more wind. Hereabouts the countercurrents of the Gulf Stream can set you southerly. That was the way we did not want to go. Thursday the tug, three friends, came to see if we wanted a tow outside, but Fred was feeling poor. To join him in his mood I washed clothes, and, fortunately, the breeze sprang up to relieve me, and off to sea we did sail with spirits high. Damn the wash! Sunday, March 17th, 1912, between Capes Romaine and Hatteras, on the inner edge of the Gulf Stream. All hands and the cook anxious to get to Beantown. Began baby's outfit as a token to the gods, who strengthened me in Jacksonville against the abortion which, God be praised, Fred did not mention. The joy has made me balmy, and so the petticoat I made yesterday for baby is now big enough for me to wear. Passed two steamers bound south, and wouldn't you know it, headwinds, washed glasses. The old steward is so blind he can't see the dirt he left on them. He probably is not so blind as careless. March 18th, 1912. Passed Cape Hatteras yesterday, p.m. Very calm. Read Prodigal Judge yesterday. Very interesting plot with three threads, all well handled. Somehow one feels as though the author might have used his talents more sanely and wholesomely in a story of more substance. It's as though Tennyson wrote doggerel. But I do hear, from whom, that Kipling did not get the poet laureateship because he wrote such obscene and witty pieces as The Bastard King of England. I do hope he did, because it's a wonderfully witty thing. Why does so much humor come from the great poets under nom de plume? Now take that bawdy song about the Kennebec whore, which I overheard on board the paddle-wheeled steamer running from Portland to Booth Bay. There's a gem of a poem, but completely orphaned. Was it Longfellow, Whittier, Bryant, or Lowell? They'd never acknowledge it, although it has real genius. Perhaps some day we Americans will become more open about some of the basic facts of life, which are certainly here to stay. March 22, 1912. Calm and bright, just about 50 miles south of Montauk Point. Fred fishing while the sails slat, I hanging out wash on the line, finishing my embroidery in the deck chair, wrapping up Father B's table mat, and generally being thoughtful about Mary Johnson's Lewis Rand and the way she handled the character development in the story, the rise and fall and final salvation of Lewis Rand. Such sparkling conversation, lucidly written. The most touching thing is Jacqueline's heroic devotion to her husband. Would that there were much more such women today. Baked marble cakes Thursday, and Fred saw to it that not one crumb was left 6 hours later to tell the story. That's devotion. March 26, 1912. Boston, would you believe it? I can't, quite. Such luck! Last week was simply awful, enough to cure the worst case of sea fever, but not mine. Gales and the highest seas I ever saw. The Hopkins, light and tiddly, would climb up a solid mountain of water, up and up until her jib-boom was invading the heavens, right straight above us, then down, down, plunging downhill into the depths, on the other side of continuous mountains, until she shuddered and shook and submarined half her length, and me trying to wash clothes. It might have been terrifying if we all had not known that she was a Thomaston-built schooner, put together by the best men in the trade, such as Oliver Ames, the Washburns, the Lehrmans, with old techniques absorbed from years of building them for the typhoons, gales, and hurricanes that confronted, for hundreds of years, the sea-going men of the town that went to sea. We made light vessel, number 90, Sunday, in the rain and fog, and anchored off Gay Head. Monday, we beat up Vineyard Sound, tacking frequently. Then we anchored, tired out, and went ashore in the launch to buy some coal for the galley stove. Tuesday, a towboat ordered by Crowell and Thurlow, as soon as they had learned our whereabouts, came alongside us, and now we are towing to Boston, hoping to get there early in the morning so as to dock before ebb tide. A fine, fair wind and some sails still set. At Vineyard Haven there was no bituminous coal. It was all nailed on account of the threatening coal strike. Finally, we purchased some anthracite, and, as the poor engineer says, "Guess I won't have time to read any of your books, ma'am, with that coal needing stoking every 2 minutes." How good the fresh meat and eggs and apples taste after the southern fare of grits and hominy and pawpaws. Out from Jayville 2 weeks tomorrow, and that makes the fresh food taste even better. The towboat bill of $200 is driving my boy daffy. Crew is unchaining the deckload of lumber. Knowing this treacherous area, I think it's a bit early. We might get a nor'wester yet and be blown hell out past Nova Scotia. This vessel has made $11,400 freight money on this round trip to Rio and back. Not so bad. So please God, no nor'wester to spoil Fred's great success with costly delays, just when he is feeling good. I hear we may be chartered for Aguirre, with molasses for some port as yet unknown. Do the French eat molasses? I must buck up my Siré with its droves of Fred's old friends, including the shady ladies. Always the spectre walks before me, but now I'm learning how to handle it. If he didn't lie so, first, when bragging about his conquest to stimulate me, when he should realize that such braggadocio is cold water to me, and secondly, when telling me my acrobatics are lacking in comparison to others. It's so easy for a man to lie to his wife about such things, and it's so easy for a wife to be a fool and listen. I shall find ways of treating it as mere boyishness, or a lack of Baptist righteousness, or something else. It's like the Kennebec logger who must jump across the river from ice cake to ice cake, always alert. Stay alert, my dear, and stay reasonably happy in the precious empire you have carved out for yourself. Have made one little slip and two petticoats for my infant's wardrobe. I shall buy some slips and flannels in Boston, ready-made. Shall also get some pregnant gowns and wraps for myself, the puffier the better, to show Fred what he's up against. Then, when I want to relieve him, I can shed them, and won't he be surprised to find me behind the facade? You're a devil, Dora, but isn't it fun? Mailed some letters in the vineyard yesterday, but must write more. If you don't write them, you don't receive them, and aren't letters a joy when entering port? Then, of course, it's a great yen my friends and relatives have for news of their wayward Dora. April 8, 1912. Went to Tremont Temple Baptist Church last Sunday, which was Palm Sunday. There was a good choir with many obviously Celtic tenors, probably Scots-Irish Protestants from Northern Ireland. God knows Boston needs such a counterbalance to the hordes of Catholic Irish, who seem to breed like rabbits and are entering all walks of Boston life. The music was splendid, but the basic fundamentalism of the Baptists peeked through the good music enough to disturb me. So I took a streetcar out to Harvard and Radcliffe to look up some old friends. Got myself carte blanche for the Harvard libraries. Saw two ex-classmates from the University of Minnesota who were doing graduate work at Radcliffe using Harvard facilities. Saw in the library some documents regarding my Brewster, Dorrance, and Putnam ancestors. The Luther Martin tribe is so profusely recorded that I merely took notes of where to research them in the future. Found I had seven ancestors fighting in the Revolutionary War, none of them eminent, except General Putnam, he of Bunker or Breed's Hill. Discovered that Fred's Hupper tribe originally settled in Marblehead, as did many other families from the Channel Islands. A mixed breed they were, which accounts for their French noses. Their tallness probably comes from Viking invasions of those handy islands, as does their wanderlust and adeptness at sea-going, to say nothing of their smuggling proclivities. Captain J.W. is moderately notorious for smuggling guns at every port he visits. Seems to me it must be dangerous, mixing with that sort of people. Mother B. arrived from Port Clyde yesterday on the Bangor-Boston steamer. Not so jolly as I remember her from our last visit. She was complaining about everything. The steamer wasn't sailed properly. The food was not to her liking. Fred's present of good Brazilian Bill was not the porter she wanted, and so on. Believe I'll steer clear of that lady and give her the widest berth I can until she moderates. Imagine telling me that my information about the name Monhegan was all wrong. 'Tis not an Indian name, she said, but merely an expression evoked of an Indian who landed on the island and found the Breton fisherman gone, says Mother B. The Indian looked about and said, "Man, he gone." That's how the island got his name. Now I say. Captain and Mrs. Dara had us on board their vessel for Saturday evening supper of baked beans and brown bread. They had purchased daffodils for me to take back aboard the Hopkins. Alice Bellano's husband, Herbert Davidson, came aboard to visit. A fond memory of our wedding, which he so efficiently arranged, while Fred hung back and combed the waterfront for a cook. Or was Fred having last-minute regrets and trying to find some accident that would prevent his getting shackled? Mr. Henderson, of the literary craft on board, and talking of having his reporter daughter, just out of Radcliffe, make a trip with us for the experience. Oh, the poor dear girl! The experience is what she will get. She's a most interesting young girl, and a reporter on the Herald staff. She is incessantly curious and questioning, and follows Fred about like a dog, fortunately not panting, but seeking erudition. He's about as good a source for reliable information as his mother was when explaining Monhegan's name. Miss H. asked the names of the 7 masts of the Thomas Lawson, says Fred. Oh, just call 'em by the days of the week. It took Dawsey to tell her the truth. Days to fore, main, mizzen, jigger, driver, pusher, and spanker, missy. We go not to Aguirre, praise the Lord, but are chartered for Humacao, Menabo, and Arroyo, and expect to sail around the 15th. Fred doesn't like to go to Humacao, not only because it is too far east and may require beating to windward if we first load in a port to the westward, but also because it brings back an episode he would like to forget. It seems that his first command, the foremaster Mabel Jordan, was given him in his early 20s, but with the stipulation from his father that he keep the old mate on board to serve not only as mate, but as counselor on major decisions. The mate counseled Fred to sail close to the Puerto Rican coast when swinging around the eastern end off Fajardo, instead of doing what Captain Arthur Elliot of Thomaston had advised Fred, that is, to steer well clear of the land, because currents set shoreward, and in a calm the ship might be set ashore on that rocky coastline. She was, and was lost. I got this story from Dan Sullivan, the lawyer who handled the case for Fred against the insurance companies. Fred took several years to recover. That's when he sailed mate with Captain Fales, refusing to go back as mate with his father, who might remind Fred, at impossible moments, of the tragedy. I shall never mention it to Fred. Saw Gertrude Elliot yesterday afternoon in a play by Pinheiro, The Indiscretion of Mr. Panmure. Rather a delight, and with good dialogue, but slight. There's a terrible truth underlying it all, that whether the girl is guiltless or not, in any indiscretion, the man goes scot-free. The girl always gets the blame. In simple terms, there's no such thing as seduction. It raised the hackles of my Midwest upbringing. Out where men treat women as something special, probably because there are so few of them, one would never hear such. Of course, in the mining camps farther west, it's different, but for homesteaders a woman is too rare and precious to maltreat. Letters from Minnesota, and all seems to be well there. They have been reading the books I sent them about the sea, and are beginning to understand, 2 years before the mast, as something real, now that daughter Dora is well into her second year before the mast. Father has been appointed Justice of the Peace, or do they elect them? Mother is hell-bent to get her WCTU chapter behind some politician named Volstead, who must have had an awful drunk somewhere in his family tree. He's so avid to do away with drink. Instead, he ought to travel a bit and see that the best solution is moderation, which can be taught in the family. I shall let my children have a bit of wine now and then, and, as the wise Catholics and Episcopalians say, drink to the greater glory of God. Grand opera in Italian last Friday evening, Girl from the Golden West. Destim is a soprano of great range, and Amata was wonderful with his deep baritone. Zanatello is a rare tenor. I loved every breath of it, and am resolved to buy a gramophone so my favorite operas can be played at sea. That'll keep Fred on deck. April 10th, 1912. It is beginning to seem that I never write in here unless I feel down. I insisted on going to see Billy Burke, got tickets for the matinee. Fred would not go and wanted me to take his mother. She was impossible. The coachman didn't know how to drive the horse to the theater. The theater was too hot. The music was too loud. The costumes were too scanty. The conversation was foolish. The thanks I got was her finding fault with me for wasting money on silly frivolities. I asked her, sugar sweet, if she would have been better off staying back in Herring Gut and going to a time at the Knights of Pythias Hall. She said that was for them others, not for her. My home suits me fine, she said. She was so disgustingly harrying and so sour that I took her for sweets to a little parlor on Washington Street, where I buttressed myself with a glass of wine. She said that no one going to sea should pay such a price for wine when they could just siphon off a noggin from the casks on board the ship. Those, I suppose she meant, hidden away from some past trip. Then she asked for a glass of wine, too, and had a second. I took fiendish advantage of her at that, telling her the Latins had a most intelligent attitude toward wines, food, and other goodies. They have a saying, I said, de lo bianco poco. It means, of good things, take only a little. It can also mean that one should be moderate on all things, such as criticizing plays. She sputtered something about people being too smart for their own britches, and we went back to the ship, she grinning and I reliving the delightful play. Billy Burke is a dainty, delightful girl, vivacious, dear, and sweetly blonde. The four-act comedy about Colette's aunt wanting her to marry the mayor's son, who is a semi-idiot, presents a relief of vivacity against the primness of the old ladies, who are shocked by Colette, who runs away and takes refuge with a Parisian artist, old enough to be her grandfather. But he's a great, good, and noble man, saving her. They're truly in love and marry before the aunts and crazy Pingo can hurt her. All good actors and clever lines. The therapy was also good for me, getting me away from those distractions of Fred and his mother, which don't lend moderation to baby's development. That's all we have time for in this edition of The Maine Reader. We're reading the log of the skipper's wife. The Diary of Dorothy Moulton Bellano, edited by her son.